Okay, so just want to look at what we've done this quarter, put it all into the very simple perspective of the same thing over and over again. But recognizing it as the same thing over and over again is difficult. So we've been looking at statistics, which I have claimed is subservient to science, and science is about proving things to people, and so statistics is about solidifying those proofs. Tend to start off with hypothesis generation, observing, but we can't address the possibility of confounding very well. We make attempts at it. We make attempts to adjust for confounding, but we can't always do that. So we refine, we confirm our hypotheses by, in the ideal, going to interventional experiments. But many times we can't do that. So at least we go to an independent sample to try to confirm. So, you know, if you've done one case control study, you go and do another one in a completely different population to try to identify the effects. At all times, we focus on the scientific method, where we think about our overall goal, our specific aims, materials and methods. We collect data, analyze it, and interpret it. If statistics is to be any use at all, we have to pass the two-question test, answering yes to both. If the world was deterministic, do we know how to answer our question? Lots of questions are not answerable in the real world. Lots of questions are very good scientific questions, but they just can't be answered. You can't separate it. And that's usually what it is in my experience, is that we want to answer a question where there is some sort of inextricable confounding, that we just can't separate two effects. But it sure would be nice to know if we could. Well, the example I usually give on that is the idea of separating sleep from REM sleep. Can you do that? And given that we just have to work in people, that the fact is that if you go very long depriving people of REM sleep, you must also deprive them of sleep. So if you were trying to say, what would happen if I let you sleep but don't let you dream? Well, the trouble is after a certain number of days, or so I've been told, I haven't personally done this experiment, but after a certain number of days, people, the second they go to sleep, will go into REM sleep. And if you wake them up, you've deprived them of both. So we just can't separate out those two effects. The same is true with everything related to sex. If you're trying to find the effect of sex on something and separate out what might be cultural effects versus hormonal effects versus whatever else is related to having mosaicism on the X chromosome, you know, it's very hard to separate those things out without also carrying along everything else that goes with the difference between the sexes. So there's many times that people come to me with very reasonable questions. I just don't know how to separate them, you know, so that you end up having to answer some related question, but it won't be exactly there. We also have to be able to turn this into a number somehow in order for statistics to be of help. We have to be able to measure the system. And then, if we do know how we'd answer it in a world in which everything happened the exact same way, we also need to know how we would summarize the results in the population, because there is variation. And so this, in my world, almost always comes down to, you know, if I'm looking at discrimination between sexes and salaries, I need to know how I'm going to summarize the salary distribution in order to be able to answer this question. I'm not going to look at mean salaries, geometric mean salaries, median salaries, percentage of people making it over a million. If I had absolutely everybody in the universe, would I know what number I would come back and
and report discrimination based on. And then what statistics helps us do is just estimate that population quantity. We can't do anything beyond that. You know, so it's if you don't know what you'd do if you had all the data you ever cared about, then I also don't know what I'd do. So in statistics, we have to make certain that we understand the overall goal, because it's real easy to divert ourselves from the overall goal by performing just simple statistics. I got asked over the weekend about the audiology data and summarizing the length of exposure to the drug. And on your last homework, where I asked you to summarize the exposure of the patients to methotrexate on problems 1 and 2, the primary goal of that was to describe how long people would take the drug if you just kept observing them forever. You know, if I just gave you a drug, anything at all, how long would you keep doing that? If I gave you, you know, Albran to eat every morning, when was it that you'd finally get tired of it and wouldn't eat it anymore? Right? Very simple question. Or when would you have toxic effects to some drug? That's one sort of question that you could have. But with the exact same data, I could ask you, just tell me how long people were taking this. Over the course of the study, I only saw 10% of the people have headaches. That's great. 10% of the people have headaches. On average, how long did they take it? If I'm trying to talk about how many headaches that you'd expect in a population, it would matter if I had them take it for 2 days, or if I had them take it for 3 months, or 3 years, or 3 decades. Those are two very different goals with the exact same data. In one, how long did they actually take the drug to, you know, sort of what is the denominator, the person years of exposure for what I'm looking at? That's uncensored data, right? I know, you know, when people stop taking the drug, then no matter how they stop taking the drug, because they died, because they lost the drug, because they stopped coming to clinic, because I told them to, because the study was over, it didn't matter. That was how long they kept taking the drug. But if I was trying to use that same data to estimate when the drug would become so toxic, or that they just didn't like messing with it anymore, or that they noticed they weren't getting any efficacy, so they wanted to switch to something else. If I was trying to estimate when that would happen to each person, now I have censored data. So the exact same data you might regard as censored for one goal and as uncensored for the other. So if you don't understand the goal, you don't know how to analyze the data. But you do have to refine it into the specific aims, the statistical hypotheses that we'd like to address. In most grants, the specific aims are still at a very high scientific level, but I don't regard them being as specific aims until I can write down the exact analysis you're going to do, because every analysis you do will answer a slightly different question. But then we have to be able to describe the materials and methods, collect the data, we advise on quality control, we describe the sample analysis to address the specific aims, and then we do interpretation. I talk about 5 different types of statistical questions because these are all the only 5 things I know how to do. I keep on waiting for some statistician to tell me that they know how to do something that doesn't fall in these categories, but they haven't yet. So we have this idea of clustering of observations and clustering of variables that I claim we do very early in any scientific setting, and that this class didn't address any methods to do that. I mentioned that they existed, but we just didn't address them. We focused on the next two, quantifying distributions. Can you tell me what the average blood pressure is among 40-year-old females? But more often in science, because we don't know what the average blood pressure should be among 40-year-old females, we instead compare the distributions across 2 groups, where one group, in some sense, represents a control, and the other group is a group of interest. This last, the prediction of individual observations, we sometimes get into that. It's, in many respects, a harder thing to do, and in many respects it's an easier thing to do. It all depends upon your role as a scientist. My role as a scientist is I like to understand things. So perfectly good predictions that I don't understand why they're good predictions, I'm not very thrilled with. Whereas other people are perfectly happy with it. Google is extremely happy with it. They don't care if the reason why you clicked on that particular ad was because you really needed to buy a stereo or because it was a cute little puppy that was posing with the stereo and you wanted to see other pictures of the puppy. Google didn't care. They get the same amount of money you're clicking on the ad, right? But I personally, I want to know. So the idea is, as I go through any particular setting, I want to understand what we call variable importance and prediction. I also do want to know, but I want to understand that my predictive model will persist on into the future. I don't want to find out that I'm pretty good at predicting who will get cancer, colon cancer, by measuring the rate of their cells dividing in their colon. If I'm thinking that that rate of cells dividing in their colon is the first sign of the cancer, rather than it's just a sign that they tend to have a, you know, high meat diet and there's something in meat that causes cancer. You know, that if you'd standardized the diet, you'd never detect that they were at high risk. So there's things like that. I just want to understand what the predictive rules are. Scientific hypotheses usually come stated. I put this in the terms of an interventional experiment, but intervention, when given to the target population, will tend to result in outcome measurements that are. And then we tend to talk about some direction of the measurements and what we're comparing them to. Some absolute standard, that was question 3, or measurements in a comparison group, that was question 4. There are multiple comparison issues in all of statistics. I don't know how to solve them. Okay, so the most we can do is be aware of them. And we make steps to try to solve them. But it's not perfect. If I truly put a straitjacket on, then I'm never going to make any multiple comparisons. Then after I have made my first statement in my life, I'm done. Right? I can't go on observationally. But what we'd like to do is be able to continue things. However, there are different clinical endpoints, many of which I think are closely related, but turn out not to be. Right? Tumor shrinkage, right? Why does cancer kill you? Well, the cancer keeps on getting bigger. That's pretty well known from observational study. Those people whose cancer keep getting bigger, they don't survive quite as long. But if we artificially go in and make the cancer be smaller, that doesn't necessarily give us better survival. So this is the difficult point that I might have thought that the same endpoint, tumor shrinkage, longer survival. But in fact, they're very different clinical endpoints once I get into an interventional experiment. I can change one without changing the other. But of course, we've talked a lot because statistically we have different tests for different summary measures, means, geometric means, medians, proportion above a threshold, and so on. And if you consider all of them, we've got multiple comparisons. How should you model your predictors? Should we model each dose group separately in the two projects, or should we fit them as some linear trend across those? Well, those are multiple comparisons, just to decide which of those two things you do. Which covariate should you adjust for? Should you go looking in subgroups? There's a type 1 error for each analysis. As we do more analyses, we will increase the chance of...
You define type 1 error.
Pardon?
Type 1 error.
Type 1 error is just the probability of saying that you have a significant association when there is not truly an association.
False positive.
But it's conditioning on that there is no effect. And this idea that you can inflate your experiment-wise error rate, if all you do is one analysis, I can attain a 0.05 type 1 error, if that was my desire. But as I do more analyses, I will inflate my type 1 error above 0.05, and it depends upon what's the correlation between the different questions I'm asking.
So if I ask two questions that are essentially the same question, then I will tend to have less inflation of my type 1 error. But if I ask two questions that are wide separate, then I can find a much higher type 1 error. Of course, as we do our statistical hypotheses, as we're doing all of these different analyses, we consider the response or outcome variable. And note that the statistical response variable might end up being what's truly thought to be the cause due to the way we've done our study. If we do a case control study where we sample two groups according to their outcome status, did they have cancer or not, and then look at how much they smoked, well, the way we need to analyze that statistically is we analyze that statistically by looking at the distribution of our risk factor across groups defined by the outcome. So the statistical response or outcome variable, we can do that either way. And then the grouping variables that we talk about are, of course, the groups that constitute our primary scientific question, which will be the predictor of interest and any effect modifiers we might be worried about. But then we will also tend to adjust for covariates to address confounding or precision. And the idea of that adjustment is just to mathematically pretend that we are comparing similar individuals. Back to the FEV, we said we wanted to compare our FEV as response variable across groups defined by smoking, adjusting for age and height. So the idea was we'd like to be able to say we're comparing a smoker to a non-smoker where the two are of the same age and the same height. We can't always get that perfectly, but as we adjust that mathematically, we adjust for the trends. This detecting associations, an association, the distributions of two variables are not independent. So it's a negative definition. And independence means basically knowing about one variable tells you nothing about the other. The way we most often analyze that is we look at the distribution of variables within groups defined by the others. So this mathematical definition that could be defined on the joint distribution, how many people are in every category of, say, smoking status and cancer status. But we usually either look at the probability of what I'm calling the outcome is the scientific outcome. So I'd be looking at the probability of having cancer given your smoking status, the cause. And if they were independent, your probability of getting cancer given you smoked would be the same as the probability of getting cancer if you didn't smoke. And that would be true for every level of smoking you might do. So that's why I had to just say the C1 and C2. I might be measuring this in pack years. But if I'd done a case control study, then I might look at the probability of smoking given you had cancer and the probability of smoking given you didn't have cancer. But the key point is all of these definitions are equivalent for lack of association. So how do we go about establishing independence? Well, we'd have to prove that this was equal for absolutely every choice. That's too hard to do. There's an infinite number of analyses we'd have to do. So usually we detect associations by proving that the two variables are not independent. This takes an element of being lucky, guessing the way in which the distributions differ. Usually we take some summary measure. We take a mean, perhaps, and we show an association, usually by one of these last two categories, showing that the expected outcome, given your cause level, is the same in every group of cause, or showing that the distribution of the cause is the same at every level of the outcome.
And this works because if two distributions are the same, all the summary measures should be the same. So we build up, as we do this, truly a hierarchy of null hypotheses that we might consider. We might say that the distribution of the response is exactly identical in all groups. We might say that the summary measure is identical in all groups, that the summary measure lies on a flat line. So that the average FEV by age would be the same in every group, but maybe the variances differ across the groups. There could be lots of other things that differ, but do that. Or the weakest null is that there's no linear trend in the summary measure across groups. Of course, if I only have two groups, these two are the same, right? If I only have two groups, the two groups having equal means also says that the means lie on a straight line. Study design affects the way we can establish an association because we should analyze our data within groups that we have constrained the sample size. If I have constrained the sample size of smokers and non-smokers, I should not combine smokers and non-smokers into one group. I should always keep them separately. Similarly, if I've combined, if I've constrained the number of people with lung cancer and without lung cancer, then I should not combine them into a single sample. I should always keep those as separate groups. So again, according to whether we have cohort studies, case control studies, or cross-sectional studies, that might dictate exactly what sort of an analysis we do. So usually, we have to define what we mean by a tendency, and we usually take a summary measure. And the idea is our summary measure would be what we would take in the whole population. It was how to answer that question, that second question that I had of saying, you know, do you know what you'd do if you had the entire population? How would you summarize that population? Well, that's what we're talking about here. Can be difficult to decide, given the idea of the salaries. Again, should we look at the higher mean, higher median, the highest maximum, the higher proportion making $1 million per year? That's a hard thing. Professional baseball players, are they well paid? Yeah, in the major leagues, but they have a terrible life in the minor leagues, right? They're not paid well, and they're traveling by bus, and they're doing all sorts of things. So, you know, how do you answer the question? Should you want to be a professional baseball player? Of course, we need to choose some primary summary measure, or we have the multiple comparison issues, because if I look at the smallest p-value among several different tests, I inflate my type 1 error a lot. Even when there's nothing going on, if I go fishing around in my data, rather than having a false discovery rate of 0.05, I'd have a false discovery rate on up to 0.17. So usually, we state things in terms of a summary measure that's defined for each group, such as a mean, arithmetic mean or geometric mean are most often used. Harmonic means are actually sometimes used, just not in this class. Medians or other quantiles, the proportion exceeding some threshold, the odds of exceeding some threshold, the time averaged hazard function. Those are the most popular ones that we ever use. And then what we do is we take either the difference or ratio. And we have habits in whether we look at the difference or ratio. Most often we look at the difference in means, but occasionally we look at the ratio. Most often we look at the difference in proportions, but occasionally we look at the ratio. Medians, in a two-sample setting, it's usually the difference. In a regression setting, the regression models that handle this are usually a ratio. We look at odds ratios and we look at hazard ratios. While I could imagine ways that you could do the differences statistically, nobody would understand them, and it would just be silly.
How do we choose which of those we do? Well, the type of data we use does make a difference. If we have binary, dichotomous data, we either take the mean, the proportion, or the odds. Nominal data, we look at frequencies or odds. Ordinal data, look at median, odds. I really look at the mean most often with ordinal data. That putting that question mark there is just a, you know, plausible deniability that there are many statisticians who say, well, you shouldn't do that, but in fact, most often, everybody compares those on the mean scale. And of course, quantitative, where addition makes sense, the mean, the median, but we do sometimes dichotomize that data for scientific reasons, and we sometimes look at hazards. Showed you this table way back when of saying this, which univariate descriptive statistics make sense. Well, that also drives which summary measure makes sense for inference. Because again, all that a parameter is, all that we're comparing as we try to make scientific inference, is something that's a descriptive statistic for the entire population. So the commonly used parameters, the table looks nearly the same as the commonly used descriptive statistics. Means are far and away the most common, because binary variables, the proportion is a mean. Poisson variables, the rate is a mean. And then with the uncensored continuous data, means are far more common. There are times that we use joint summary measures, such things as the median difference, or the median ratio of paired observations, or we could also talk about the mean ratio as being a joint summary measure, but the mean difference, that's okay, that's the difference of means as well. But the issue of these joint sum measures, including the one that is the Wilcoxon test, the probability that a randomly chosen measurement from one population might exceed that from another, or the maximal difference between cumulative distribution functions. I happen to not like any of these measures because they're non-transitive, because you always have the possibility that quantifying the difference between two groups, you can't look at the relationship between A and B, the relationship between B and C, and be able to guess what the relationship between A and C would be. So that's true of all of these measures. How do you choose a summary measure? First and foremost, this is always a simple way to answer any question I ask, is how do you choose something? You just say science first and then statistics. And science in this case comes in two categories. First is what's relevant, what's answering your current question. But then if there are several things that are answering your current question, then you might as well go after something that it's likely to differ in. Only if all other things are equal can you choose among your summary measures according to the statistical precision. Scientific summary measures summarize the distributions of meaningful measurements, do contrasts across populations. Okay, these are the estimates. That's all I'm talking about. Statistical measures, how precisely we estimate a scientific measure. These are either p-values, correlations. There are some other things that we can put in. Those are not telling us about the scientific quantity. Those are telling us how much we know, not how much we know about what. So just giving me a p-value or just giving me a correlation is not as valuable as giving me an estimate and then describing that estimate according to the precision. So the p-values describe something about the estimate, but first you'd want to know what those estimates are. At data analysis, before looking at the data, there's a lot of things that you have to understand. So you refine it to specific aims, make certain you understand your variables scientifically, then start thinking about how you classify your variables statistically. We've talked a lot in discussion section about differences between confounders and precision variables in particular, because the way we treat those variables has to be different. Even when we adjust for them, we're more worried about the way that we adjust for confounders than we are about the way we adjust for precision variables. So again, as we try to think about these things, if you suddenly tell me, say, look, you know, I'm adjusting for so many things, I can't do it all, I don't have a large enough sample size, I say, well, drop the precision variables. Then at least you're still answering the same question. But don't drop the confounders, because if you drop the confounders, you're not answering the question you need to answer. And then also, since time is limited, we're all mortal, spend your time thinking about how you model the confounders, but, you know, sort of doing what first occurred to you about the precision variables will usually get you most of the precision. Usually. Of course, an effect modifier. Well, an effect modifier really ought to be part of your question. You go looking for effect modification, you're going to find something that looks significant, and then your question was not, does smoking affect boys and girls differently? But instead, your question, if you started going fishing through your data, is, what do you think the two variables are that will come up with a p-value of 0.023? There will be one. There will be one. But the random variable is, which analysis came up with that? And it's not reliable. It's not reproducible as a general rule. But if you had a question about effect modification, then your question is whether the association between your response and predictor of interest differs in strata defined by your effect modifier. You are, in effect, saying, I don't think there's one answer to my question. You're saying, the association between smoking and lung function. If you ask me that question, I have to say, are we talking about boys or are we talking about girls? That's what effect modification would say. Effect modification, unfortunately, depends on the measurement of effect. It is possible to have no effect modification on the median, but to have effect modification on the mean. And just to make it more exciting, it's possible to have no effect modification on the difference in the means, but to have effect modification on the ratio of the means. So these questions are very, very hard to answer. You really got to understand what it is you care about before you go looking after effect modification. And quantifying it is generally very hard. It usually takes a very large sample size to be able to identify effect modification reliably and to estimate it reliably. It's not as good at it. And usually, as soon as we find effect modification, we never again do the analysis in the same group. Once we find there is a difference between children and adults in their response to some particular drug, we all do analyses in kids and we do analyses in adults, and we don't bother throwing them all in the same analysis anymore. They aren't helping us borrow information. Yes?
So you just said the difference in the mean?
Yes.
What if in, like, the table 1 or 2, you're seeing what you think might be an effect modification, and you've predicted that a priori in
yes.
just, like, your baseline descriptives?
Yes.
Do
so
you still go ahead and then check a difference, or are you saying, no, if you can state there's a difference? And
but if you thought there was the question, and the idea is, you know, who are you? Are you the person who devised this whole experiment, or, like I usually am, are you somebody who's called in late and that you then end up, you know, based on that same idea, end up saying, you know, we really ought to look at this separately because of these things. And again, without looking at the data, then that's a more robust analysis. It's still prone to all of my biases, but it's more robust analysis than to have me look at the data and say, look, we're seeing a difference here. That doesn't change the fact that a major part of science, most of science, is observational. So as we do that observational science, don't ignore something that you see in the data. Just don't claim we've answered that question. Don't say your headline is, you know, effect of peanut butter on men different from women. You know, at the end of your thing of saying peanut butter, you know, sticks to the roof of your mouth, then at the bottom say, you know, and in exploratory analyses. You know, just make that, that's the issue to make clear. When you're analyzing the difference of means of continuous data, stratified smooth curves,
that are estimated precisely. You always have to watch about how wiggly they are. They're non-parallel. Graphical techniques to detect effect modification are difficult in other situations. So in this picture where I had an unadjusted analysis and it seemed to be a straight line, horizontal, but when I analyzed by the two strata, I found the lines were markedly non-parallel. Okay, that's effect modification. This works for scatter plots when your interest is the means. That's it. And it really works on the difference of the means, not the ratio of the means, because we have a hard time judging how the ratio changes. So when the scientific question involves effect modification, analyses must ultimately be within each stratum separately. And if we want to estimate the degree of effect modification, we do a regression model, which will typically include the predictor of interest, the effect modifying variable, and a covariate that models the interaction, which is usually a product. Okay, and this is by habit. There's lots of other interactions that you could do. But if we were interested in the effect of smoking being modified by sex in FEV, we would have put in a variable that measures sex, a variable that measures smoking, and we probably would have put in the product of those two variables, a variable that's sex times smoking. This is much more the subject of BioStat 518 and any other statistics course that you take in the rest of your life. By design or mistake, we sometimes don't model effect modification, and then we either do an unadjusted analysis or we do an adjusted analysis. The concept of confounding still exists, even if what you really have is effect modification, but you choose not to model that effect modification, that you choose to ignore that. The classic case of knowing that there is strong effect modification, but we ignore it ultimately. However, we always adjust for the confounding is when pollsters are trying to decide who will win for president. They know that one neighborhood in the city votes very differently from another neighborhood in the city. So there is confounding. But ultimately what matters is the unadjusted analysis. Who gets the most votes? So when that is what you're ultimately interested in, we sometimes do special sampling to find those neighborhoods that are swing neighborhoods. We do analyses adjusted within each of them, and then we take the average across all of those analyses, properly weighted. So the idea that we would do this. So while it is true that if you had the privilege of really looking at things and saying, is this effect modification, confounding, or precision? If you have the question about effect modification, you answer that one, and then you no longer care whether it's precision or confounding. But if you aren't interested in answering the question about effect modification, then we do come back down to saying, is there potentially confounding? So confounding, the association between a predictor of interest and the response variable, is confounded if the third variable is associated with the predictor of interest in the sample, and the third variable is confounded with the response causally in groups that are homogeneous with respect to the predictor of interest and not in the causal pathway of interest. On a graph, well, since in confounders, the estimates of treatment effect, if it's a pure confounder, it's the same across strata. And the confounder is causally associated with the response-independent predictor of interest and associated with the predictor of interest in the sample. Well, when we're looking at the difference of means of continuous data, stratified smooth curves of data are parallel. This is if it's pure confounding. Again, we talked about that concept of the effect modification. And the distribution of the predictor of interest differs across strata. And in this setting, unadjusted and adjusted analyses give different estimates. So this is a case where when I didn't adjust for that third variable, we had a downward slope, whereas within each stratum, we actually had an upward slope. And it's often hard to tell the association between the confounder and the X variable. Here I made it extreme.
these lowest values of the X variable all come from the same stratum. These highest values all come from the same stratum. So I'm sure that that distribution is differing. But sometimes there's more overlap. And then what you really want to find out is how the means differ across those groups. You adjust for confounding based on beliefs about the causal relationships among measured variables. It's a standard of proof. If everybody thinks that sex is associated with something, then you adjust for sex. That's just the breaks. You cannot test for confounding. So never give a p-value to tell me whether there's confounding or not. It just is completely irrelevant. There can be confounding when the p-value is not significant. There can be no confounding when the p-value is significant. So since the confounding is a product of the association between the predictor of interest and the third variable, then a small association with a strong predictor will lead to confounding. The p-value is about associations in the population, not in the sample. So it's a judgment call. Confounding typically produces a difference between unadjusted and adjusted analyses, but these symptoms are not proof of confounding. So just because you see a difference does not mean there was confounding. It does mean that we often suspect it. But such a difference can occur at times when there is no confounding. Doesn't happen with differences in means, but it does happen with odds ratios and hazard ratios. Precision variables, estimates of the treatment effect, are the same across strata, and the variable is causally associated with the response, and the variable is not associated with the predictor of interest in the sample. When analyzing difference of means of continuous data, the stratified smooth curves are parallel, and the distribution of the predictor of interest is the same across strata. And the unadjusted and adjusted analyses will give similar estimates, but not similar standard errors. So, pictorially, you might see this. Of course, then we get into doing our analyses, descriptive statistics. We have five different reasons that we look for descriptive statistics, and the particular descriptive statistic that we use will tend to differ according to why we're wanting to do it. So to identify measurement or data errors, missing data, the minimum, maximum is generally it. To characterize materials and methods, then anything that describes your sample is good. So the mean, standard deviation, minimum, maximum, median, or quartiles, all of those are good. In a journal article, you may not have room to put all of that all the time, so that then you have to choose. Then usually what drives the way I choose them is what will serve other purposes as well. By the time I'm writing a journal article, I have found all of the errors that I can find. So it's less important to put the minimum and maximum, but for materials and methods, I may still want them. When it comes to looking at the validity of scientific and statistical assumptions, confounding is a major thing that I like to be able to assess. I'm comparing smokers to non-smokers. How did they differ on other variables? Confounding is a function of the difference in the means of the variables that you would adjust for to remove the confounding. So it's means. Means are most important. So that question mark that I put with the means is only a question mark because if you were going to model the log bilirubin to adjust for confounding by bilirubin, then it would be geometric means that I would have wanted to see instead. So it's the mean of the variable that you would think you could adjust for the confounding for. That's what matters. And then you try to get simple estimates of effects. That's really towards inference. And you do hypothesis generation. That's often looking at nonlinearity of effects, or it's looking at effect modification. Inference, we generalize from the sample to the population. We get point estimates, interval estimates.
And then we do testing, quantify the strength of evidence. That's usually the p-value. When we report associations,
imagine the hypothetical study to detect an association between event B and exposure F, unexposed 0 of 5 have event B. I can give you the estimates. I can give you the Kant's interval. Exposed 3 of 5 have event B. Again, do that. I give you a Fisher's exact two-sided p-value because it's such small samples that a lot of people would say that's what they would do. And how would you characterize this? Big point. Because the confidence intervals overlap, there's no association. No, we need to use a p-value for the one difference. This is not the criterion we use. There are ways that this can be used, but it's really quite complicated to know exactly how to use the criteria. Independent strata. If two independent strata do not overlap, we know it's significant. If the point estimate for one stratum is inside the confidence interval for the other stratum, then we know it's not statistically significant. Otherwise, all bets are off. Overstated purely statistical report. The p-value is greater than 0.05. We conclude there's no association between exposure F and event B. We shouldn't conclude that because we lacked precision to rule out difference that might be of interest. Scientifically useless, as the p-value is greater than 0.05, we conclude that there's not sufficient evidence to rule out the possibility of no association. This is correct, but it just doesn't give us any idea about the true science of the situation and the study setting. Incidence rates of 60% in the exposed, 0% in the unexposed, but unfortunately precision was not adequate to demonstrate that such a large difference in incidence rates would be unlikely in the absence of true association. And if you were looking at the probability of being male or female and giving birth after a year of unprotected sex, these statistics are not bad for those small sample sizes. So you can see what the problem is of saying there is no association. We know well there is association. Analysis methods. In this quarter, we described tests and sometimes confidence intervals. Whenever possible, we describe confidence intervals for comparing parameters across groups. Not all are implemented in software, but most of them can be obtained in most software packages. There are some tests which could technically be applied in certain situations. It's not very often seen or recognized. There are technical assumptions. The major ones we need is approximately normally distributed parameter estimates. Sufficiently large sample sizes will get us there. Appropriate handling of correlated data, independence versus matched samples, and appropriate estimation of the variability of the estimated parameters, homoscedasticity versus heteroscedasticity versus a mean variance relationship. And then we have just a bunch of tables of the different things that we can do according to what you're trying to compare on the left-hand side and then what kind of data you have across the columns. And we have a lot of different tests. Some of these we haven't talked about. It's just the fact that there are tests like that. We have the idea that we may have to use bootstrapping for the difference in medians that I had you do on homework idea. If you were finding ratios of medians where I gave you those complicated formulas that came from the Delta method, where we could combine standard errors in a very straightforward manner. Then if we had independent samples, the t-test, the chi-square test, which is nearly the t-test, very nearly the t-test, are the mainstay of our existence. Matched comparisons, we have such things as the paired d-test, the McNamara's test, sign test, that deal with all of these same situations. And then regression methods, the infinite sample problem, where we're looking at borrowing information and making contrasts across multiple groups. We have continuous predictors of interest, or we want to adjust for variables. That's when we retreat to regression. Simple regression, we'll be talking more about this today.
but that we have used so far to get our least squares estimates. Now we'll talk about inference. These regression models are just differing in what summary measure they're looking at. And then everything being regression, the most commonly used two-sample tests are just special cases of the regression. And so really all we're doing as we do regression is generalizations of those two-sample tests that we've talked about. So in BioStat 518, you go to multiple regression, which deals with the far more complicated things of varying dose response, the different things that you could do to adjust for things, looking at effect modification. Time-varying covariates, clustered data, and so on. Okay.